it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker of the day, Dr. Mary Zanarini. Dr. Zanarini is a professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and the director of the Laboratory for the Study of Adult Development at McLean Hospital. She's been the recipient of research grants from the National Institute of Mental Health, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the National Alliance for Research on Schizophrenia and Depression. In addition, she's chair of the NIMH Work Group for the Development of Guidelines for Treatment Research on Borderline Personality Disorder and chair of the World Federation of Societies of Biological Psychiatry Task Force on Personality Disorders. Dr. Zanarini's research focuses on describing the phenomenology, etiology, and long-term course of borderline personality disorder. His work has led to the increasingly accepted view that, believe it or not, borderline personality disorder is a good prognosis diagnosis. So if you didn't know that, be sure to use question and answers to ask Dr. Zanarini all about that. She's also conducted numerous treatment trials of psychotropic medications and psychosocial interventions for borderline personality disorder. And more recently, she's been studying early onset BPD in children and adolescents, as well as the genetics of BPD. Finally, she's developed interviews that are widely used to diagnose and to assess change over time in treatment studies of BPD. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Mary Zanarini.
Thanks, Chris. My talk today is not going to take the whole 15 minutes, so you can all cheer that you don't have to pay attention for that long. But more importantly, when I'm done, I really would like to open up a discussion, not only answer questions, but people give me their thoughts, because this is a talk about where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. Now, the existing guidelines for the treatment of borderline personality disorder were encompassed in a APA manuscript called the Practice Guideline for the Treatment of Patients with Borderline Personality Disorder, and this came out in 2001. And the chair of this committee was John Oldham, at that time of Columbia. The members were Glenn Gabbard of Menger Clinic, Marcia Boyne, who at that time was head of the APA, John Gunderson of McLean and Harvard, Paul Soloff of Pittsburgh, David Spiegel of Stanford, Michael Stone of Columbia, and Kathy Phillips of Brown. And this was a group that carefully reviewed all of the literature. These were all experienced clinicians, and they wanted to come up with something practical and yet scientifically stable. The recommendations were that individual therapy is the primary treatment for BPD, and this is the only disorder that the American Psychiatric Association has recommended therapy as the primary treatment, I believe. They also came up with an algorithm, really relying on Paul Soloff's early work about medications and BPD, for the initial medications aimed at different symptoms of BPD. And they were interested in dealing with three types of symptoms: affective dysregulation, impulsivity, and cognitive symptoms. And this algorithm, which if you've ever seen it, I was going to try to replicate it for a slide, but I didn't have something that was sort of the size of an entire wall, so I gave up. It was SSRIs for affective dysregulation, SSRIs for impulsivity, and low-dose neuroleptics or antipsychotics for cognitive symptoms. Now, the limitations of this very careful synthesis of existing knowledge really was that it was formulated almost a decade ago and right before the publication of a large, at least by BPD standards, body of new studies concerning the psychotherapy and the pharmacotherapy of BPD, so sort of right at the wrong time. But that's great that we have so much new stuff. At that time, when it was probably being discussed in 2000, or even perhaps earlier, only DBT, or as you know, dialectical behavioral therapy, was empirically based. And they also discussed psychodynamic therapy that was vaguely discussed, but was probably transference focused. And medication algorithms consistently led to aggressive polypharmacy with no evidence base. And many psychopharmacologists have complained about these algorithms that leads to very aggressive use of medication, very expensive use of medication, again, with no evidence base that that's useful. Now let's talk about the evidence-based therapies. You've already heard from Joan Wheelis on dialectical behavioral therapy, or DBT, that was developed by Marsha Linehan of the University of Washington. Mentalization-Based Treatment, or MBT, developed by Anthony Bateman and Peter Fonagy of London. Schema-Focused Therapy, which is based on the work, or SFT, of Jeffrey Young. And Transference-Focused Psychotherapy, or TFP, developed by John Clarkin, Otto Kernberg, Ken Levy, and Frank Yeomans. Now, there is a newer comprehensive treatment that is not, the results have not yet been published, but have been presented by Shelley McMain and Paul Lace of Toronto, and it's called General Psychiatric Management, or GPM. And it combines psychodynamic psychotherapy and medication management, and its findings, if this is published, are really quite interesting in that one session a week was as effective as DBT. And we'll see. We'll hear hopefully more in the years to come about this manualized treatment, which is based, I believe, on a concern about dealing with people's attachment issues. But it's quite open-ended, and it's different than Marsh's treatment in that they use medications, and they're not opposed to that. And the treatment's somewhat less structured and more open-ended. Now, there are adjunctive treatments, and I don't know how much you've heard about these already, but I'll just go through them. There's the Systems Training for Emotional Predictability and Problem-Solving Steps, and the title is so complicated, even though I'm involved in this work, I can never remember what it's about. I know what it's about, but I can't remember what the name really means. But it's developed by Nancy Blum and Don Black of the University of Iowa. And this is a brief 20-week group therapy, which is cognitive behavioral in nature. It's sort of, in a way, DBT light. And it was developed because in many parts of the country, there simply is no way to provide one of these more comprehensive treatments. They're just too expensive and too intensive. There have also been some local efforts, manual-assisted cognitive therapy, or MCMAC, by Igor Weinberg, who's here today, and John Gunderson, which was aimed primarily at self-mutilation. Acceptance-based emotion regulation by Kim Gratz, who used to be at McLean but is now at Mississippi, and John Gunderson, and that's also based or aimed at self-mutilation and psychoeducation for borderline patients, where what we found was that if you simply provide people with education about BPD, they actually become less impulsive and the relationships are less stormy. So it's an interesting form of pre-treatment or very early treatment. It would indicate that what you know may help you control yourself a bit. As long as you have a cognitive map, you might feel a bit better. Now, controlled medication studies, there have been many since the guideline was published. These studies of second generation antidepressants, mood stabilizers, and antipsychotics have all been shown to take the edge off of BPD symptoms. And what's interesting is they take the edge off by the same amount and the same symptoms, which sort of defies the algorithm completely. It just doesn't seem to work that way. You give these people almost anything. If you have a good psychopharmacologist and a good research assistant, they seem to do pretty well. But none are curative. And you might say, well, that's both not a surprise and a disappointment. But then I think the medications for depression, for bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia aren't curative either. So it's a mixed bag with medications. The bad news is that many of these medications, particularly the second-generation antipsychotics, have been associated with substantial weight gain and other side effects. And in a study I'm going to tell you about, the McLean State of Adult Development, where we've been studying the long-term course of BPD for 17 years now, over a third of our subjects have become obese or morbidly obese, body mass index of 30 or more or 35 or more, primarily due to their meds. And many people who are normal weight at baseline, you know, maybe 5'5", 130, way in the 200s now, it's the patients who haven't done as well have gained the most weight because they're on the most meds. But this is something for us really to seriously consider. How much do you want to medicate someone when there are these long-term problems and side effects? What are other medication findings as I try to update you? First of all, we found that monotherapy is as effective as polypharmacy. This is the only trial looking at this, and we studied olanzapine versus the olanzapine-fluoxetine combination, and there really was no difference. So two medications may not be better than one. and every psychopharmacologist in the room may disagree with me, but that's what we found. Interestingly enough, we also found that pharmaceutical-grade omega-3 fatty acids were as effective as commercial mood stabilizers by effect size, with no side effects and less cost. And there's also less stigma. People don't mind taking omega-3 fatty acids if their workmate asks them, or they might mind admitting taking a mood stabilizer or something else. I think this is interesting and deserves replication. Now, family therapy, John Gunderson developed a multiple family groups treatment, I believe in the 1990s, where families got together to discuss their issues and learn things about BPD and share things, the pain of their lives and the pain of their child's life oftentimes. And Perry Hoffman, who's the president of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder, NEA-BPD, the very vigorous advocacy group that has really changed the way all the researchers in the field think about things, families think about things, and NIMH thinks about things, has developed a program called Family Connections that really does the same type of work as she teaches, her group teaches the families about skills that they can have so that their relative is less upset and therefore they're less upset. Now, the British perspective, Anthony Bateman and I sort of co-gave this talk in the fall, the NICE guidelines recommend that long-term psychotherapy is better than short-term psychotherapy. They also recommend, interestingly, that no medication perhaps should be used for treatment of the symptoms of BPD, which is what happens. Why we have four or five meds is there four or five symptom clusters with BPD. So there's one med per symptom. But that medications can and should be used for the co-occurring conditions for which they were developed, depression, anxiety disorders, and so on. So this is a really departure from the American recommendations in many ways, especially around medications. Now let's think of these four main psychotherapies. Should they be engaged in a competition or should there be a consensus? Now these therapies share many features and the results of trials suggest good results, and this is an idea that I share with Anthony Bateman, who articulated this very well about a year ago, that if a therapy has a reasonable intellectual foundation, is carried out by reasonable people, and in a reasonably enthusiastic and consistent manner, you're probably going to get good results. And that would suggest consensus rather than an armed competition with various founders of therapies wrestling around various conference rooms in a manner that's frightening to all of us. And what an eye-opener. Now, I personally think it's a waste of time trying to determine which of the big four is best, because each may be best for different patients and different therapists. Not all patients want the same things. Some patients want symptom relief. Other patients really want to understand their problems. Some therapists feel comfortable in a teaching role. Others feel more intellectually alive if they're listening, forming hypotheses, and so on. They also have different personalities. But each of these therapies may also be better than others for different times in the course of a patient's life journey. It's possible, for example, that DBT may be best up front when people are really dysregulated and out of control. Maybe some of the other therapies would be better when patients feel less impulsive, their life is more stable, and they're in a more reflective mood. But we don't know that. But I'm pretty sure that NIMH is never going to fund a head-to-head trial of these treatments. At this point, they're desperate just to keep funding something, but not these big trials. The reality check is that most patients in the U.S., even in Boston, will not receive any form of evidence-based treatment. In the longitudinal study I described to you, which has about 300 borderline patients, less than 10 have ever received any of these treatments. And that's because they're just not available. They're not available to people without means. They're not available in poor neighborhoods, whether they're in the rural areas of the state or in cities. They're certainly not available across the U.S. except in a few centers. And my personal idea is that if patients are mildly to moderately ill with BPD, they may not need it. You might say, what are you talking about? took me a long time to realize, even though I started my career in an outpatient clinic, that the patients we see at hospitals, the patients we all receive training on, or with their help, are not actually the typical borderline patients. Many people with BPD have mild cases, and they never are in the hospital. And we don't actually even tend to think of them as borderline, but they are. They have less comorbidity, they function better psychosocially, but they have the same inner anguish, and they may well have a history of self-mutilation and so on. And these patients probably will never get these treatments, will never be recommended for these treatments. But I think they would benefit from having an informed therapy. I think one of the points John's been trying to make to all of us and in this conference as well, I would suspect, is that it's no longer acceptable for us all just to have our own little therapy that we feel really good about, but can't really describe what it is we're doing or even why, that there needs to be some kind of connection to what others have learned, and that such an informed therapy would probably be partially cognitive behavioral in nature and partially psychodynamic. It's a rare therapist who's psychodynamic, who isn't concerned about practical issues, and it's a rare cognitive behavioral therapist who doesn't really notice and get it what the person's issues might be beyond their diagnosis. Now, the goals of therapy in general, we all know, are to feel better, to function better, and to understand oneself better. But there are two models of therapy, and one is, certainly they are at McLean, one is that therapy is an adjunct to life, and the purpose of therapy is to facilitate enough change that the patient is open to the reparations of adult life. For example, getting a more mature partner, work that is a source of pride and esteem. Now, this may seem very obvious, but oftentimes I think people get so involved in their work with patients, they lose track of the fact that we're supposed to encourage them forward and that life has a lot to offer them. Our wonderful insights probably are not as comforting as getting married to a reasonable person, and so on. And what I call this is get a life therapy. And I started saying this to patients, and people were sort of appalled and slam my office door and then come back and say, well, what do you mean by a life? I didn't realize I was supposed to have one. I thought I was just supposed to be in treatment. Another model is that therapy is a lifestyle. The purpose is to process and understand every event and relationship. And you might say, well, this is ridiculous. This is psychoanalysis. Borderline patients are going to not be in this. But they, in fact, often report in my longitudinal study, especially in the first, let's say, 5 to 7 years after their index admission, that they were seeing their therapist 3 to 5 times a week. Some sessions would go 3 and 4 hours in length. They were working over all their trauma issues, although they seemed to be getting re-traumatized in these treatments, where they were remembering more and more whether it actually happened. They were getting sicker and sicker. And so therapy can be a lifestyle, even for people without a lot of financial means. And we have to really wonder, is this a good lifestyle for anyone, but particularly these folks? Now, what are the impediments to treatment in the U.S.? 40 million Americans have no health insurance, and I'm sure as this recession, depression continues, there are going to be a lot more people uninsured. And that the parity bills that have been in effect for a while typically do not cover BPD, and hopefully that will change with the new federal law. And we also all know that mental health benefits are managed in some way and strongly encourage the use of medication, including expensive newer medications, and discourage long-term therapies, even if they're supportive in nature, but usefully supportive in nature. The patient has been hospitalized for a long time, is able to work, but just doesn't have it within her to make friends or have a stable enough life that they can survive without some kind of support. And often the medication regime is 3 to 4 times the expense of a therapy appointment, which is also interesting. Now let's talk about the course of BPD. As was briefly mentioned, there are two NIMH-funded prospective studies of the longitudinal course of BPD, our own McLean Study of Adult Development, or MSAD, and the Collaborative Longitudinal Personality Disorders Study, CLIPS, that John was the original main player, and I had a role as well. And this is a study that's been conducted at Harvard, Brown, Columbia, and Yale. and the results of these studies have converged that the prognosis for BPD is better than expected. When we began this study, BPD was a diagnosis that people didn't really want to give patients because it seemed like it was a chronic condition. But what we discovered is that remissions are extremely common. For example, in the first 10 years of the MSAD study, 93% of patients achieved a remission of BPD. Recurrences are relatively rare. This disorder is very different than mood disorders, which are quite quick, relatively speaking, to have a remission, but recurrences are almost ubiquitous. Where here, you slowly move toward remission, but you don't necessarily have a recurrence. It's more like growing up than recovering from an illness in some ways. And suicide is much less common than previously known. For example, in the first, actually we know up through year 16, 4% of our subjects have died rather than the expected 10%. So something has really happened, I think, to offer these patients more understanding around their childhood adversity, more support, so that suicide is not so much of an option for them. Now, let me talk about a complex model of borderline psychopathology. I believe that there's a hyperbolic temperament that's the outward face of the neurobiological dimensions that underlie borderline psychopathology. And by hyperbolic temperament, I mean these patients are in enormous inner pain. I think it's the most distinguishing feature. But their pain isn't just by itself the most distinguishing feature. They also have a hyperbolic temperament. They're like Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. Attention must be paid. And they're going to get your attention in a variety of ways, talking about their pain, making suicide gestures, harming themselves. And the trick with working with these people is to get them to talk about their pain, to be more direct. It's not going to go away for a long period of time, but talking indirectly through action is not useful. But in this model, after kindling of some kind, which could be childhood adversity, adult adversity, or a normative event like going to college, acute and temperamental symptoms develop. Now, what are acute symptoms? Acute symptoms of BPD resolve relatively quickly. They're the best markers for the disorder because they're the most dramatic, colorful symptoms of BPD. They're often the main reason for expensive forms of psychiatric care, such as inpatient stays, residential stays. And they're akin to the positive symptoms of schizophrenia. Once you've seen them, it's hard to forget them. Temperamental symptoms, on the other hand, are relatively slow to resolve. They're not specific to BPD. Patients with many other conditions have them, and most of us probably demonstrate them as well. They are associated very seriously with ongoing psychosocial impairment, and they're akin to the negative symptoms of schizophrenia, which really means that once the storminess of BPD is over, we're still going to have these symptoms to deal with. Now, let me give you some examples of these symptoms. Acute symptoms would be self-mutilation, suicide efforts, quasi-psychotic thoughts, and temperamental symptoms would be being angry, feeling angry, acting angry, being distrustful and suspicious, and abandonment concerns. But let me actually give you the list that we studied 24 symptoms, not 9 symptoms, and there was only one affective symptom that was acute in nature, affective instability, the very fluctuations and moodiness of borderline patients was relatively acute. Cognitive symptoms were quasi-psychotic thoughts, as I mentioned, and serious identity disturbance. You might say, what's identity disturbance doing in cognition? Beyond having to put it someplace. The other reason was that many people's identity disturbance is based on false beliefs about the self, overvalued ideas, I'm bad, ugly, stupid, fat. Impulsive symptoms are acute in nature, substance abuse, being promiscuous, looking for love in all the wrong places, self-mutilation, as I mentioned, and suicide efforts. Other acute symptoms are interpersonal in nature, and the storminess of borderline relationships, people basically fighting a lot, breaking up a lot, running in and out of the house, a lot of chaos, being devaluative, manipulative, or cruel. Things that people don't like to admit these patients have, but are no big deal, and the patients in many ways feel relieved if you can acknowledge that they have these problems, and many of us do, and let's just see if we can work on them. Being demanding and entitled, certainly one that I've encountered in non-patients. Serious treatment regressions. and countertransference problems, and we all know that some therapists get really angry at these patients and dismiss them from their care after providing them with Madonna-like tenderness over an extended period of time that's soul-crushing. And special treatment relationships, the truly unfortunate things where treaters start to become friends with patients and even have love affairs with them, and that there's certainly no reason to think that's useful. Temperamental symptoms. Most affective symptoms of BPD we found were temperamental, which makes sense. Being depressed, feeling helpless, hopeless, worthless, being really angry, very anxious, being lonely, empty. Cognitive symptoms that persist for quite a while and that seem to be part of the person's natural personality. Odd thought, for example, overvalued ideas, and unusual perceptual experiences, for example, depersonalization, and non-delusional paranoia. Many of these people are quite distrustful and suspicious, and given what some of them have gone through, it no longer seems on the border with schizophrenia, it seems on the border with having grown up in a contentious and unhappy world. Temperamental symptoms of an impulsive nature, other forms of impulsivity that are not specific to BPD, for example, eating binges, spending sprees, reckless driving. And then the interpersonal symptoms, intolerance of aloneness, abandonment, engulfment, annihilation concerns, counterdependency, something most of us know a lot about, and undue dependency and masochism, probably the thing we're trying to hide. So what are the symptoms that resolve most rapidly? What's the synthetic message here? The acute symptoms are those that reflect either core areas of impulsivity, for example, as I mentioned, self-mutilation and suicide efforts, or active attempts to manage interpersonal difficulties, having stormy relationships, being devalued, manipulative, cruel. So the very things that most upset clinicians, whether they're inpatient nurses or outpatient social workers, the reality is these are the things that get better most quickly. And while this is a treated sample, this is a naturalistic study. And so most of the patients were receiving probably once a week psychotherapy and some kind of medication. But it seems to me these symptoms almost resolved with the help of the treatment, but not necessarily because of it. And the more stable or temperamental symptoms, the affective symptoms reflect either the symptoms rather affective in nature, reflecting areas of chronic dysphoria, as I mentioned, anger, loneliness, emptiness, or the interpersonal symptoms reflecting abandonment and dependency issues, for example, intolerance of aloneness, counterdependency problems. And these, again, are the symptoms that hold people back psychosocially. You can cut yourself and still go to work as a lawyer the next day, but if you're so worried about abandonment and so fearful that people will forget your pain, that you need to remind them all the time, you don't have the energy to actually go to work or school. Now, the focus of our current major treatments, the four I mentioned, are typically acute symptoms. They all seem to focus on self-harm and suicide attempts or the consequences of acute symptoms, people being hospitalized or having ER visits or making emergency phone calls. And one other thing I would suggest is that we need treatments in the future that are aimed at temperamental symptoms. And maybe these treatments do, if they go on long enough, or maybe they could be expanded. But I think we actually need treatments that are specifically aimed at temperamental symptoms, and patients understand that. They may need coaching to accept these symptoms as relatively chronic for them and to learn to get around them. In other words, they may need strategies working with you as a therapist for normalizing temperamental issues. It's not the end of the world to have abandonment concerns. What's not useful is the fact if you're desperate and show them to people in an awkward way, it actually repels the very people you wish to keep close. And they may also need strategies for successful adaptation to these symptoms. You're very anxious, you're very shy, but in fact, you can make a friend. And how do we go about that? And some of this may seem, sometimes I think some therapists feel this kind of work is beneath them, but I don't think it is. Our goal is all the same, to move people forward. Another focus for the future is I think many of these patients need help in the social realm. They need to figure out how to make and keep friends, because while they do well in inpatient units, they often become somewhat friendless as they proceed through life. But they're eager for friendships. They often have no clue how to initiate and manage romantic relationships. Many patients have told me they're too damaged from their childhood adversity ever to form an intimate relationship. And they also need help to repair family relationships and or to gain greater autonomy from their parents, and probably both at the same time. Many of our patients over time have turned from a hostile, blaming attitude toward their parents to one of acceptance that their illness truly is their responsibility. Their parents did the best they can, and most of the parents were not sexually abusing their children. But many of these people also need to gain greater autonomy. Even spending your time fighting with your parents for hours every week means you're enmeshed in there, and you really haven't formed a life of your own. You can find someone of your own to fight with. You don't have to fight with biological relatives. Now, there's also a need for vocational counseling with many of these people. Many of these patients, despite high levels of intelligence and good education, are relatively clueless. How do you look for a job? How do you behave in a job interview? I shouldn't have worn my jeans. How to handle going to work when tired or upset, which is a big one. Many people with this diagnosis, and many others, frankly, including many of us, have a hard time understanding you actually go to work even if you haven't gotten 8 hours of sleep or if you're upset, and you actually can function when you get there, and also how to manage conflict at work. And I often think of a patient I treated for a long time when I was much younger, a woman who was the executive assistant to a major business figure in Boston, who described fighting with her boss and hating him and this and that. But she found a deep and ugly place where she finally destroyed her own career. One day when she said to him, clueless as the consequences were about to come, now I know why your first wife committed suicide. And it was a real surprise to her that he picked up the phone and called security, human resources. She was escorted out, lost a very high-paying job, and that you really can't say everything you think. And perhaps you shouldn't even think some things. I think a lot of these people also need life coaches. In the past and today, I've hired mental health workers at McLean to actually teach my patients things. How to use public transportation. Yes, people actually do travel on buses and the subway, and you actually have to know how much money to have and how to handle the machines and so on. Budget and use a bank. Many patients have no idea how to use an ATM machine. They'll approach the bank and look at the machine, and they need help. Shopping for groceries is better if you go in with a list. Cleaning one's home, something perhaps one should do more than twice a year. And laundry, there actually is not a laundry service for most of us. You approach a machine and you put the laundry in and so on. They also, even though John's early work certainly showed that these people had a good social adaptation compared to people with schizophrenia, many of these patients do not necessarily have the world's best personal hygiene. And Barbara Stanley mentioned this to me, and she said, we need a course on ADLs for people with BPD. They're not all young, trim, and wearing fashionable outfits. Sleep problems are very common. A young psychiatrist working with our group, David Plant, has a paper coming out about sleep problems in patients with BPD. They often don't sleep well. They frequently take sleep meds, which may not be that useful for them. In addition to all their psychiatric meds, it's almost impossible to understand if they're still conscious at the end of the day, but then the sleep med, that's added on. They have tremendous issues with physical pain, and they're often taking very serious pain medications, often opioids, which have their own side effects and own problems. Now, psychotropic medication, my personal recommendations would be that if a patient is suffering from a clear-cut comorbid condition, they're massively depressed, they should have an antidepressant. But that requires that doctors distinguish depression, which is an illness, from chronic dysphoria, which is part of the borderline state. If someone is simply miserable and unhappy and has no neurovegetative signs, it's unlikely any antidepressant is going to help them. So do you want to use that medication? And we also, I think, need to, all of us working together, therapists who are not MDs and MDs who are providing medication, need to work to use restraint in other situations. And remember that borderline patients are often unhappy and functioning poorly, and meds will certainly not give them friends or a job. It would be fabulous if it did work that way, but it doesn't. But to remember that if the patients get someone or something in their life, something to be proud of, something to feel secure about, they will feel better. Another thing about meds is that I really think there's no evidence to use more than one med at a time to help decrease the severity of BPD symptoms. And I think the British idea that maybe even no meds at a time might be useful in that regard, because that would actually give a message to the patients. There's nothing magical about taking away these symptoms. You've got to work to get over them in many ways as we help you to follow a trajectory that perhaps looks like growing up. I think we need to be very clear with these patients that meds will only help a little and they'll only be used for a limited time. So many of these patients have been on meds for 10, 15 years, and it strikes me that they're not on them because the meds are so useful, but they're so devoted to their medication doctor, and there's such a ringing affirmation that they're in pain and distress. I remember working with one resident at McLean about a woman who was by then in her 40s and was quite overweight and quite chronic and was no longer working. He said, well, she was always that way. And I thought, well, gee, when I met her 20 years ago, she wasn't that way. But he wouldn't believe me until he went to medical records and got her chart. And yes, she really was 5'5", 120 pounds. She really was a high-functioning professional. And she really had a life. And how is it that she doesn't anymore? What is the story of this woman's life? We also need all of us. There's not a psychologist, social worker, or anyone else in here who's not an MD who treats these patients who should just blow off their meds. I don't know what my patient's taking. You see them more often than the doctor, and you should be monitoring them on a weekly basis, perhaps informally, but you should know and form an opinion. Are these things working? Are they helping? Are they hurting? We all need to pay attention to their side effects and the long-term health effects of standard medications. Obesity is not a worthy treatment goal. Obesity is attached to all kinds of embarrassing and debilitating symptoms. For example, urinary incontinence is very common in our obese borderline patients. And if you want to get a job, you want to get a date, having that as a social problem or a physical problem is not a good way to go. Now, clinicians, typically, meds are prescribed by a psychiatrist or a primary care doctor, but we may need across the country, and even in Massachusetts, which has poor rural and urban areas, we may need to use nurse clinicians more widely. And I'll leave that to doctors and nurses to wrestle around the room. But one of my earliest supervisors was a master's level nurse who was clinically gifted and certainly could do this job easily in her spare time. And typically, therapy in Massachusetts is provided by a psychiatrist, a PhD-level psychologist, or a licensed social worker. But we may need, here in the poor areas of the state and also throughout the U.S., to use master's-level or even bachelor's-level counselors. These people, with the right temperament and the right training, can do a good job. A lot of the stuff we spend learning in school, physicians learning about endocrine disorders or psychologists learning about statistics, really aren't particularly helpful to our patients with psychiatric disorders necessarily. Now, there are several newer self-pay initiatives which are really for folks with lots of resources. McLean has a DBT-based unit for adolescents. It's called 3 East. It's a 4 to 6 week program of intensive residential treatment. It's not an inpatient unit. It has an open door. And it also just recently opened a step-down program for longer stays. And the adolescent girls in this unit are doing, look exactly like the adults with BPD. They're as young as 13. But they seem to really, we don't know if they're actually getting better because of the treatment or they're just getting better. But this is certainly an interesting program. And McLean is about to open, as you probably heard during this meeting, an adult unit called the Gunderson Residence that's both DBT and MBT informed, and treatment will go somewhere from 2 to 4 to 6 months, depending on the patient's needs, and it's a halfway house in Cambridge. Now, going forward, I think we need new guidelines for treatment in the U.S. and throughout the world, more funding certainly for treatment research. Now, what is the research I would suggest? I think we need to develop and study more cost-effective treatments. Such treatments can be adjunctive in nature, or they could be standalone treatments. They can be discrete modules aimed at specific symptoms, such as MCMACT, or they can be part of a multifaceted treatment that is phased and is needed. But the reality is, these treatments are wonderful, but they're expensive and complicated, and even centers of excellence are having trouble providing them because they really are expensive. And in conclusion, I think that BPD is a highly treatable disorder, and the results are more important of these studies than winning closely argued points. The time when people are going to be arguing over this and that point may be interesting to them, but probably not so much to the patients. And I think what we need to remember is that this is a disorder with a dignity and a power all its own. Thank you very much. So we have time for questions. Questions, thoughts, comments? Yes, sir.
Yes, it seemed to me there are a lot of the slides you put up there that are not included. It seems that there are a lot of slides that you put up there on the screen and not in our books here. I don't know if that's unique to me or something that others noticed. But,
I revised them, I believe, on Thursday morning.
Is there a way to get some of the slides that you put up there?
Sure. If you email me at santorini@mclean.harvard.edu, I'll send you the slides. Yes, in the back, in black.
I have a lot of students at our school that have sleep disorders and have the BPD diagnosis. What are the most useful things besides sleep medications that
my expert that I rely on is David Plant, a young psychiatrist doing a postdoc in sleep medicine at the Brigham, and he believes medications are not particularly useful for this group and that they do know something about sleep hygiene already, going to bed at the same time and so on. He thinks that there are cognitive behavioral interventions around sleep that can be particularly useful for this group. And if you'd like to contact him, he has an email address on the partner's website. I think it's dtplant@partners.org, and if many of you write him, I'll write him before so he isn't surprised. David Plant. @partners.org. Yes, in the back.
I work in a social service setting where I see a lot of people for a one-time evaluation. And I would say over 50% of the people with borderline personality disorder that I see have been in a lot of different treatment settings that have never received that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And I find, for a variety of reasons, enormous resistance when I give them that diagnosis. I'm wondering if you've addressed that at all in your research and from a public health standpoint.
Yes. When we started our psychoeducation study, people were sort of frightened for us that we were going to tell 50 young, actually late adolescent women that they had BPD. But because I believe this is a good prognosis, telling all 50 led to a few tears, but a lot of relief. They were happy to learn that they were ill rather than bad or evil, or that they were alone. And in fact, one said to me when I looked sad, apparently, when I was telling her, she said, "Oh, Dr. Zanarini, borderline, schmortaline, it's the thing to have nowadays. Don't be so sad." So I know exactly what you mean. Patients have picked up from treaters that there's another word that begins with B that could be a synonym for this disorder, and resent that, and rightly so. And I think that's the problem. It isn't the patients who are worried about this. It's the treaters who get frustrated with these patients, don't know the latest research about this being a good prognosis of disorder, but I would not be afraid, if you feel positively about this disorder, to tell people. They have a right to know. There are treatments for it, and they should know what they have.
No, what I was referring to is actually resistance to the mental health and medical system.
Yes, there's also a lot of resistance there, and I think for the same reasons. People feel it's a hopeless condition, which it isn't, treaters, and they often sort of project their own negative feelings onto the patient and can't tell them the diagnosis because they think they're telling them they're a bad person, when in fact they're telling them they have a specific illness with a good prognosis. Yes, sir.
What are the levels of omega-3 that you found effective?
What are the levels of what?
The levels of omega-3.
You know, that fact is, what did we use?
We just looked at doses, so we don't know levels.
Okay.
I don't remember the doses.
What, do you remember the dose?
It's in the American Journal of Psychiatry.
It's an article in the American Journal of Psychiatry a couple years ago. Other questions? Yes, here in the front.
I have two questions related to training the next generation of psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers. One is, with so many different treatments and so little time to train people who are in a program for, say, 2 years, they may just get a mishmash of being introduced to many different approaches. That's one question. And the other is the concern about mixing the different therapies when we're told that, well, you might do that, but there's no evidence base for mixing cognitive and psychodynamic.
I think John has already given a talk indicating that we may be coming to a place where people have to be certified in one of these treatments. And it is difficult. I've heard from, example, Mass General residents that they got their DBT instruction in the emergency room as they're coming off shift when they've been up for 24 hours and were asleep against a wall, which, you know, is not the best training for DBT. I don't think there's any way that any program can provide comprehensive training in all of these treatments because all of the training programs are relatively brief and have lots of other pressures on them. What I would do is encourage young people who want to work with these patients intensively to get some kind of staff position or postdoc in a center of excellence where they can learn these things slowly over time and pick the one that makes the most sense to them. Yes, Otto.
I'd like to congratulate you for that wonderful comprehensive presentation.
But?
Most important. I have a minor question regarding the division between acute and temperamental symptoms, in the sense that you use the term temperament in a very broad way. It includes both temperamental issue in a strict sense, constitutionally given dispositions, mm-hmm. etc., and a characterological one. Would mm-hmm. it be helpful to separate it out somehow? Because temperament you can't change, but whether you can change character or not is part of the treatment of personality disorder. That's an open question. Mm-hmm. So there might be an advantage. It's just a terminological issue.
Right. I think it's actually more than just a question of terminology. I think it's really a question of how we think about these things. And in many ways, I think these traits, if they change at all, change really slowly and more in response to life and growing up than to treatment. But it is, many people have suggested that temperamental symptoms is not the world's best choice of language, and I certainly will try to think of something else.
And then we've got one at the back.
Okay.
I just had a question regarding any thoughts you had on atypical depression versus PPD. I've had a couple of clients recently who have been diagnosed with atypical depression, but they look to me, you see more like borderline diagnosis.
Are you talking about people who eat too much, sleep too
much?
Pretty
much, yeah. They're on a host of medication, but nothing seems to be working. The medication's doing nothing.
Right.
The McLean visits aren't helped because basically they need, I think they need more of a DBT or some other kind of.
Well, I think what we're talking about is, are these people depressed or are they demoralized? And I think borderline patients get a lot of special terms. At McLean, it's hard to find a borderline patient that's not received a diagnosis of rapid cycling bipolar disorder. And having 10 cycles in a day is not my definition of bipolarity. But for some reason, despite the fact that work by some people has shown that the course of bipolar disorder is not as positive as we had once thought, people would rather give that diagnosis than BPD. And again, it's what this gentleman mentioned in the back. what is with clinicians that when this is a good prognosis diagnosis, they insist upon diagnosing something that's far more biological with a far worse outcome. It's interesting, and I hope with a new generation of leaders, like any of the people in this room, that'll change.
So we've actually got time for one more right now.
Okay.
You spoke about therapy as a lifestyle, and I was just wondering, what about people who are addicted to therapy? I mean, how does a therapist finally decide that this is just someone who's addicted to therapy and not really getting anything?
Well, I think what's important is seeing what the patient thinks. I had a patient who was a medical student who moved to the Midwest, and she said, well, what kind of therapist do you think I should have next? And I said, well, how about taking 6 months off? And she said, you're just messing with my mind. And slammed out of my office and then came back and said, do you think I could survive? And I said, yes, and I think you could also consolidate some of your gains. And then she said, oh, there goes that big vocabulary again. Our shoe special. So basically, I think you have to think about it yourself, and you have to gently introduce the topic of, are we doing anything here? Or, like, for example, I had a patient who wasn't borderline, but he insisted on continuing to come, although I treated him since the age of 16. He even got a job at McLean as a mental health worker, and he was so protective of me, he wanted to make sure that my life was going to be okay, and was particularly transfixed by the fact that I drove a Saab car at the time, which he thought was some kind of statement about my personal life or anguish. And so some of these people are also protective, and they need to learn that not only can they survive and benefit, but we can survive too. Plus, our door is always open. If you haven't moved and you want to come back for a refresher course, this young man I just mentioned came back when he was about to get married. He came back when he and his wife were having trouble carrying a child to term. So there's always a way that you can stay engaged with somebody. Cannot. Therapy is such an investment of time, not only the part of the therapist, but the patient. People need to have some energy left to live their lives. But thank you very much.